It's been a long time since I've given a sermon on the parasha. And as I was seeking the Lord and saying, Lord, what in the world am I supposed to be preaching on? I heard that I would preach last week, so I had all week to cry out to the Lord. You know, Lord, what would you have? What would you have? Silence, silence, silence. I've just given, like 30 sermons in the States. Don't I just pick one of those? Silence, silence, silence. Lord, I'm running out of topics. Silence, silence. And I kept feeling, well, just do the parasha. People don't want to hear the parasha. Do the parasha. Okay, so it's the parasha. The power of a pun in the parasha. I'll repeat that. The power of a pun in the parasha. And that's not a pun, and it's on purpose. That's alliteration. And with the whole week, why didn't I come up with a good pun? Well, oh, by the way, you're... Okay, he got it. Are we rolling, Bob? Yeah, okay. Why not a pun? It's very popular in America. A lot of people give jokes. There's people that you can't talk with them for more than 3 minutes, but they've caught you in a pun, and they're always coming back at you, and they're just waiting for you to have a smile to acknowledge that, they did a pun on you again and again and again. We like puns. We use them for jokes. We use them just for good humor. Sometimes we can use them sarcastically. We can get a dig in on somebody. We can make fun of something with a pun. So we use them for humor. We make fun of people. What we don't do in our culture is we don't take them seriously. A pun is not something that you use for... teaching, for preaching, for philosophical truth, theological truth. That's not what puns are for in our culture. So, we didn't write the Bible. Bob Dylan comes from a long line of people that like to say serious things with tongue in cheek, even in the Bible. So I would like to look at Genesis 32 through 33. We'll do half of the parasha. We'll do the good half. And we're going to see some puns. We're going to see repetition, a little bit of pause. We're going to see very careful control of point of view. What we're dealing here is with a well-told story, a masterfully told story. I feel bad. Maybe some of it is because of translation. When you're in translation, you can never follow a pun. Jokes, puns, that kind of thing don't translate. You can put it in footnotes, but the impact doesn't come across. And so the well-told storiness of this story does not come across to people. And you read it and you go, well, it's just a simple story. And people that come at it and they ask historical questions, they say, well, who are the witnesses to this? And how do we know it happened? And, where are all the other details that we want to know? When he moved from this point to another point, if we were going to do it as a movie, how did he do it? Who went out in front? And who was he talking with? All of the kinds of questions that we would know, that we would need to know the answers to in order to recreate a scene, in order to recreate a good historical movie, are missing. Because that isn't what the author was concerned about. He had other things to do, and he did them with the devices that he thought were good, that he wanted to use, And what I would like to do with us today is read through Genesis 32 and 33, and I will try to bring out some of the themes that are in this passage that the author brings out through pun and through repetition and through careful control of point of view. Now, when we're done, we should even have a lesson for us, and it should apply to us. Because when you read a story like this, and when you see how carefully put together it is, you can also see a little bit about God, and you can see often too much, you can see how you fit into the story. So it's a story about Jacob, and that alone almost brings smirks to people's to say it's a story about Jacob, in African folklore there's something called the trickster stories. And Jacob is very much a trickster. His character is known. And the poor character is going to unravel right in our parasha. But we'll come to that. First, we're going to start off. Let's see. We'll read from English, and I'll try to remember what was going on in Hebrew. I'll start at the very beginning, in chapter 32, right before the parasha begins. I mean, the guy that wrote Genesis, he didn't know where these parasha breaks were going to come, so we will have to bear with that. As Jacob went on his way, some angels met him. And when he saw them, he said, "This is God's camp." So he called the place Mahanaim. Verse 3, the verse we just read. Jacob sent messengers ahead of him to his brother Esau in the country of Edom. That just reads like flat prose to us in English. So now I have to go back and bring out the first one of these puns and themes that are going to be going on. Actually, right here we have one, two, we've got all of them right here. We've got three major themes that are being set up for us. So Jacob is on his way. Where is he on his way from? Well, he's on his way from the east, from the land of Laban, from Laban's place. He's run away, as it were. He snuck out. He made peace with Laban. He was coming back to the land of Israel, where he had also run away from, because, well, for one, I suppose he needed a wife, but for two, his brother wanted to kill him. And I don't know which was the stronger motivation. But he'd finally grown up, and he was able to come back and face his brother again. So he's on his way. And we'll find out that he was worried, very much so. And he comes to what would be, halfway down the east bank of, coming across Gilad, halfway down to a river in Jordan, to a place that is now called Mahanaim. So he comes, he gets to this place. He sees angels. It says, some angels met him. And when he saw them, he said, "This is God's camp." So he called the place Mahanaim. Now, if you're doing a movie or you're asking historical questions, you wonder, what's the purpose of a bunch of angels running around on a spot here? They met him. Did they talk? Was there a purpose to this? Was there, absolutely nothing is said. It just says he sees angels and he calls the place Mahanaim. From some storytelling tradition's eyes, this would be very, very strange. But not for our biblical writer. because he gets to set his story off now. The word for angel, malachim. He comes here and some malachim meet him, some angels. And I'm going to have to turn over to my Hebrew text because I might not remember everything. He sees a company. He sees them as the camp of God, Mahne Elohim. And so he calls this Mahnaim. This is God's camp, so he called the place Mahnaim. There's a play on the word camp and Mahnaim. And for angels, it's the camp of God, but it's angels of God that meet him. And in Hebrew, Malachei Elohim. Now, why is that important? Excuse me. There's only one of those here. Why is that important? Because in the very next verse, it says in verse 4 in Hebrew, is that verse 4 in English? No. It's verse 3 in English. Verse 3 in English, Jacob sent messengers ahead of him. Messengers are also malachim. And in Hebrew, that comes across much too loud. You can't ignore that when you're reading this in Hebrew. You know you're being set up. As you're reading through these stories in Hebrew, you can see that the author is saying, get ready, we're going to have a nice story here. And Malachei Elohim meet him. Angels of God meet Jacob. And he sees them as the camp of God, and so he calls the place Mahnaim. Well, that needs a story. And he didn't give it yet, so it's coming. And then the next verse, and so Jacob sent Malachim before himself. And now you know you're being set up because he sees angels, unexplained. They have no purpose at all in the story. And all of a sudden, Jacob is sending out angels. He's sending out his messengers. He could have sent servants. He could have sent men. You know, there were a lot of things that the story writer could have called this. But he, no, no. Jacob sent his angels in front of him. Those of you that were here at 9 o'clock heard about me. I have three angels sitting over there. But they're staying here. I'm not sending them on someplace else yet. Well, Jacob sent his angels, his messengers, before him to Esau, his brother. Now, lefanav, before him, is a little bit extra also. You wouldn't have needed to say this in the text. You could have simply said, Jacob sent his servants to Esau, his brother, in the land of Seir. Or, I mean, there were a lot of ways. He sent his men, he sent his servants, he sent so-and-so by name. A lot of ways he could have said it. But he sent his messengers, or slash angels, before him, lefanav. In Hebrew, the word lefanav is, you know, at his faces, at his face. He sent his angels at his face to Esau. And so you start wondering as you read this story, is this author perchance going to do anything with lefanav in this story? And the answer, of course, is yes. He will be also dealing with lefanav to his face. We'll find out about faces later on in the story. Comes up time and time again. I mentioned that repetition is one of the devices of a good storyteller. And for them, it's serious. This is the hard part. Talking to an English audience, you hear about pun, you hear about telling a story, and we think, oh, this isn't serious. For this, it's very serious. You know, this isn't just any story. This is a story that I can tell you about Mahne and Mahnaim and about Malachim and about Panim, about faces. So, let's hear the story. And let's remember that it is serious and it does have something to say to us. Because Jacob is in serious trouble at this point. It's like his whole life is coming together against him. And if any of you have ever been in trouble, then this is a good story, a very good story. When you feel closed in, when the walls are coming in and it seems the room is smaller than it used to be, this is your story. He instructed them to say, this is verse 4 in English now, I, Jacob, your obedient servant, report to my master Esau. Master here, by the way, Adoni, to my Lord. That's going to play in the story too a little bit. I mean, it shows the humility, it shows Jacob trying to repair a relationship that was broken. Chuck just mentioned that as he stepped down after the offering. To right broken relationships. Jacob is ready to right a broken relationship, and when he approaches Esau, he takes a very humble position. But the wording is also interesting because of using this Adoni that can be used in normal speech, but we're going to see again in this story something not normal take place. So, tell him, my master Esau, I've been staying with Laban, and I have delayed my return until now. I own cattle, donkeys, sheep, goats, and slaves. I'm sending you word, sir, in the hope of gaining your favor. Verse 6. When the messengers came back to Jacob, they said, we went to your brother Esau, and he's already on his way to meet you, and he has 400 men with him. Okay, what's happening? You've read your Bible. Did you notice that as the story is being told, the messengers never actually got to Esau and talked with him? There was no, now the messengers arrived and Esau greeted them at the gate and they entered and said, here's what Jacob says, and they said, blah, 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 blah. And Esau says, oh, very good to hear, and here's what I returned, blah, 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 blah. And then it says, and so they left and they returned. And then when they came back to Jacob, they said, we have met Esau, and they said, and blah, 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 blah. None of that kind of repetition, something that does happen in other stories. But as this author is telling the story about Jacob, he wants us to see it not from an omniscient perspective, not from God's perspective, not from the pan-historical perspective. He wants to make sure that we are able to feel Jacob's shoes. He wants to put us in Jacob's shoes so that we can feel some of Jacob's fear. So we don't get to see these messengers meet Esau, and we don't get to hear what really happened. All we get to hear is what Jacob heard. Jacob sends his angels, his messengers, and the next thing we know, they're back. The messengers came back. The angels came back. And he's got 400 men. And verse 7 is very important for us to understand and be with Jacob in this tight little room that seems to be getting smaller. Jacob was frightened and worried. If I remember right, that word worry even has the idea of being, it says in Hebrew, and Jacob feared greatly, and it was a constraint to him. He was uptight, pressed in from all sides. Translated here, worried. Not a bad translation, but we have to get into Jacob's shoes. His world is shrinking around him, and we don't even get to see outside of Jacob's world right now. And he thought, if Esau comes and attacks... Oh, I skipped a verse. He divided into two groups the people who were with him. And also his sheep, goats, cattle, and camels. Also interesting. Vayahatata'am. Okay, he doesn't use the word. Ah, yes, he does. At the end of the verse, and he divided them into two mahnot, into two camps. And again, this word camps comes up. It's one of these threads that the author is carrying through the story to let you know something very important is going on. Camps, Mahnaim means camps. Mahnaim means two camps. Here it says it in a different way, so he divides them into two camps. And you go, oh, we're right, a good story is coming. And we might be a little bit afraid because we're feeling it from Jacob's side. So two camps. And he thought, if Esau comes and attacks the first group, the other may be able to escape. We get to hear his fear. Now, how did Jacob make that choice? He divided them into two. What went on? You know, did he draw lots? You people go there, you people go there. Who went into the first group? And how would you like to be in the first group, the group that gets to meet Esau first? Well, if you were listening to your leader, Jacob, you might not have very much confidence. And I wondered what it would do for relations inside the Jacob camp to know that he put you in camp number A, the camp that, well, that's expendable. How would you like to have been put in the expendable camp? All valid questions, but none of them part of our story here. That wasn't... We're seeing Jacob's fear, not the fear of the servants. So, again, the statement is simply made, but we pass on and we pass over what could have been very many interesting details that we don't need. So we go on to verse 9. Then Jacob prayed, God of my grandfather Abraham and God of my father Isaac, hear me. You told me, Lord, to go back to my land and to my relatives, and you would make everything go well with me. Remember, he just heard 400 men are coming against him. And there's no police force, remember, in this. I mean, if things got out of hand, you don't just run to the nearest police station and say, help. There's going to be 400 people out there. I'm not worth all the kindness and faithfulness that you have shown me, your servant. I crossed the Jordan with nothing but a walking stick. Now I've come back with these two groups. Save me, I pray, from my brother Esau. I am afraid. Afraid he is coming to attack us and destroy us all, even the women and children. Remember that you promised to make everything go well with me and give me more descendants than anyone could count, as many as the grains of sand along the seashore. We know the outcome of the story. It's hard to feel the panic that is with Jacob right here. But if you can't feel his panic because you know the end of the story, then just remember the next time you're in panic that the day will come when you'll be able to look back from the end of the story. And even if you prayed as superficially sometimes as Jacob, although here it's not so bad. We talked last week about the prayer, you know, Lord, if you would do good for me, then I'll be your servant. Here he's saying, and you promised. If you find yourself in a point of panic, God has made all of us promises. And we can learn from Jacob, our father, as it were, a very human father. And we can pray, Lord, remember, you've promised. You've promised to help us. Let's go on to verse 13. Oh, this translation. After spending the night there, Jacob chose from his livestock as a present for his brother Esau to... Oh, too bad. Um, Let's see, where are we now? Verse 14. Vayalen sham balaila hu vayikah minaba. Oh, okay. Well, there's a little something here anyway. I was thinking in verse 21 we're going to get another pun, but there's almost a wordplay on that in this one. So he spent that night there, and he took from his possessions a minha, an offering, a gift. Well, minha is just has two of the consonants of the word camp, mahne, reversed. So he takes from his minha. He's going to give a minha for Esau, and in seven verses we're going to run into another one of these word plays. So he takes as a present, as a minha, and so you can listen to that sound with mahne, 200 female goats and 20 males, 200 female sheep and 20 males, 30 milk camels and their young, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 males. He divided them into herds, put one of his servants in charge of each herd, and he said, "Go ahead of me. Leave a space between each herd and one behind it." And he ordered the first servant, "When my brother Esau meets you and asks, 'Who is my master? Where are you going? Who owns these animals in front of you?' you must answer, 'They belong to your servant Jacob. He sends them as a present to his master Esau.' Jacob himself is just behind us." And he gave the same order to the second, the third, and all the others who were in charge of the herds. "This is what you must say to Esau when you meet him. You must say, 'Yes, your servant Jacob is just behind us.'" Jacob was thinking, "I will win him over with the gifts. And when I meet him, perhaps he will forgive me." He sent the gifts on ahead of him and spent that night in camp. Okay. He sent the gifts on ahead of him. He sent the mihna al panav, on his face, on ahead of him. But again, we're getting this word face repeated. It's been repeated actually several times through here, but we don't have time for everything. Vehu lan balaila hahu bamahne. And he spent the night there. And the syntax here flips around. It's not the syntax, the simple storytelling syntax he could have used. He wanted to stop it to develop the next part of the story, and he went out of his way to do this because he's put a pronoun. You can't see it in English, but the he gets stuck in front in order to use this other structure. And he spent that night in the camp. Again, underlining this word camp, in the camp. Unnecessary part to the story, but something's going to happen, and he's setting us up. He's letting us know something's going to happen, that the storyteller is in control of the story. So hang on and listen. And here we come to the next verse. So he got up that night. Is Jacob afraid? Listen. He took his two wives and two concubines and 11 children, crossed the river Jabbok. He sent them across and also sent across all he owned. But he stayed behind alone. So he sends a camp on up ahead. Was he really afraid in sending... he figured they would be looking for Jacob at all costs, and so he was going to be away from everyone, maybe. Was he afraid? Yes. He stays behind all alone. Then a man came and wrestled with him until just before daybreak. And when the man saw that he was not winning the struggle, he struck Jacob on the hip, and it was thrown out of joint. The man said, "Let me go. Daylight is coming." Well, Jacob knew what was going on. "I won't unless you bless me," Jacob answered. "What is your name?" the man asked. Sneaky, Jacob answered. That's one of the meanings of Jacob. That's why I said there's a little bit of a smile that comes in when you know you're going to hear a Jacob story, and you know the kind of person Jacob is. If you also know that one of the meanings of Akav, to follow after, another one of the meanings is to trick or to cheat. And we do have that name in, at least in the Wild West, when we had cowboys and people took on all sorts of names, first names, and they didn't like to use their last names. We had cowboys named Sneaky. What's your name? Sneaky. The man said, your name will no longer be Sneaky. You have struggled with God and with men, and you have won. So your name will be Israel. Israel. It's wonderful. The name Israel, and this I'm going to thank Dov for. I didn't know this historical reminiscence. We're reading the Parashat HaShavua this week. This year it happens to be in the first week of December. But 51 years ago, this parasha was being read in the last week of November. Now, 51 years ago was 1947. And, see, was it the 27th or the 29th? 29th, thank you. Some of us Americans aren't up on our history as well as we should be. The 29th of November, 1947, the UN was in session. It was a Shabbat. And they voted on partition. Partition of the land of Palestine, the mandate of Palestine, and it was to be divided into two groups, two camps, Mahanaim. The people are reading the Parashat HaShavua of Mahanaim in the parasha that Sneaky gets a new name, Israel. And was there rejoicing? Was there a sense of 4,000 year divine pun going on? Absolutely. Israel got a name. Israel got the promise to set up their state. They chose the name Israel, not surprising. I mean, historically they could have called it Yehud, but they called it Israel. Our story goes on. Jacob said, now tell me your name. By the way, it is interesting that the story writer here says, now Jacob said, because he's not done telling the story from the human point of view. Sneaky says, now you tell me your name. But he answered, why do you want to know my name? And then he blessed Jacob. And Jacob said, I have seen God face to face. And I'm still alive. And now we start seeing why some of these panavs were in the story earlier, because the storyteller knew where he was going. I have seen God face to face, and I'm still alive. So he called the name of the place Penuel, or Peniel. And the sun rose as Jacob was leaving Peniel, and he was limping because of the hip. And even today, the descendants of Israel do not eat the muscle which is on the hip joint, because it was on this muscle that Jacob was struck. We're only through one chapter, and we've got a whole chapter to go. So what I think I'm going to have to do is pull out a couple puns and summarize. Anyway, Jacob sees Esau coming, 400 men. He divides everyone up. Now we get to hear how he does it. He takes Leah and Rachel. He puts the concubines and their children first. Sneaky at work. Then Leah. Finally Rachel and Joseph at the rear. Jacob went ahead of them and bowed to the ground 7 times as he approached his brother. And picture that. Bow down, get up, walk forward, bow down, get up, walk forward, 7 times. Jacob was trying to make his relationship right, and that is worthy of example for all of us. Very excessive. Was Jacob afraid of his brother? Absolutely. Did he need to be afraid of Esau, his brother? God could have even revealed it to him. Maybe if Jacob were of different character, he would have. But now we get to verse 3 and 4. For, and Esau ran to meet him, threw his arms around him, and kissed him, and they were both crying. Jacob's fears melt. And when Esau looked around and saw the women and the children, he said, "Who are these people with you?" "Well, these, sir, are the children whom God has been good enough to give me." And the concubines came up with their children, and Leah and Rachel. "And what about that other group I met? What did that mean?" "Well, that was to gain your favor." "Well, I have enough. You keep what you have." And Jacob said, "No, please, I have gained your favor. Accept my gift. And to see your face is for me like seeing the face of God. Now that you've been so friendly to me, please accept this gift which I have brought you. God has been kind to me and given me everything." Jacob kept urging him until he accepted. "So let's prepare to leave. I'll go ahead of you." And Jacob says, "Well, you know the children are weak. We can't keep up with you. We'll come later and see you in Edom." Never says he did. At least Sneaky doesn't. And Esau says, "Well, then let me leave some men with you." We don't get to read between the lines. The author keeps going. What are those men going to do with Jacob if they're left behind? Like a prison guard, maybe. I don't know. But also protection. It's probably meant out of the goodness of his heart. But you wonder how much Jacob has recovered from his good standing. There's no need for that. I only want to gain your favor. So that day Jacob started on his way back to Edom, but Jacob went to Sukkot, where he built a house for himself and his livestock, and that's why the name is called Sukkot, another wordplay. And on his return from Mesopotamia, Jacob arrived safely at Shechem in the land of Canaan and set his camp in a field before the city. And he bought that part of the field from the descendants of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of silver, and he put an altar there and named it after El, the God of Israel. Okay, our time is up, but we do get a moral to the story. What is that? An exciting story to read? Yes. It tells us about the importance to mend and to right broken relationships. It also is a story that should stay with us whenever we feel cramped. Whenever you're surrounded by problems that are too big for you. Even when you've been scheming. None of you scheme, I'm sure. But even if you have been, there's hope. Not because of your schemes, but just because of God. And don't criticize God because he doesn't reveal to you how it's all going to work out, because Jacob didn't get that either. Maybe it's because of who we are and because of who Jacob is that God can't reveal that. But there's still hope. And we can meet with God. And in the struggles of our lives that we get caught up with, it might seem like we're wrestling with God, and maybe we are sometimes. Maybe sometimes we're wrestling against God. But this story from the parasha gives us hope. And the author wants us to know that. He wants the people of Israel to know that. The God of Jacob, the God of Israel, is a God of hope. He's a God we can struggle with. And even when the walls of our room crush in upon us, it's the God of Israel that we can cling to. We can find hope. We can find help. And that's a powerful word we can have for this week. Amen.